Our guest in this next hour is Professor Jeremy Suri, speaking on his new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Professor Suri offers a bold new history of the American presidency, arguing that the successful presidents of the past created unrealistic expectations for every president since JFK, with enormously problematic implications for American politics. He argues the presidency is a victim of its own success. The vastness of the job makes it almost impossible to fulfill the expectations placed upon it. As managers of the world's largest economy and military, contemporary presidents must react to a truly globalized world in a 24-hour news cycle. There is little room for bold vision. Jeremy Suri is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and also taught here at the UW-Madison. So his visit was a nice reunion among friends, faculty members, and former students. The talk took place at the Central Library in Madison on November 2, 2017, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute and the Wisconsin Book Festival. Now, Professor Jeremy Suri.
Thank you. Wow. It's so wonderful to be here and see so many friends. Many of you have been instrumental in my career. Many of you were students of mine. Many of you were colleagues of mine. And thank you so much. It's really, Madison will always have a special place in our hearts. There's no place like Madison. So I'm a believer, obviously, that history matters. I'm a historian. And I actually think a lot of our problems today, and we certainly have no shortage of them, they're problems that come from an insufficient understanding of history. And you might say Americans have always had this problem. People who visited the United States in the 19th century made this point. Alexis de Tocqueville made this point. James Bryce made this point. But I think there's a particular problem now. And that particular problem is that we not only don't know our history, we fundamentally misunderstand our history. We have a teleological way of thinking about who we are as a society. We believe that we are a great society because somewhere along the line, we got the secret code. And if things don't work right, it's because someone somewhere is denying us the secret code, that there's some eternal syrup that makes Americans great. It can't be genetics, right? As much as we might say negative things about certain people, it can't be genetics because we all come from different backgrounds, right? So somehow we think there's something inherent, God-given, that's made Americans great. I'm here to tell you I'm a lover of the United States, but actually what has made us the society we have become is a set of historical choices, a set of historical decisions, a set of historical sacrifices that citizens made generation after generation. And we need to study those and think about those sacrifices, not because we will relive them today. You never step in the same river twice, but because we have to understand how important that approach to the world is for our society going forward. We risk today becoming an empire in decline because we are convinced of our righteousness, convinced of our power, and unwilling to improve ourselves, when the history of our society coming to this moment has been constant struggle for improvement, constant struggle for change. And the reason I wrote this book, among many reasons, was because I think the changes in our society over the last 200 years have been inspired, encouraged, shaped, in part, not entirely, but in part by our leaders. Or to put it in other terms, although we have never had perfect leaders, and we have had some leaders we wish we didn't have, we have generally been blessed as a society with leaders who have brought out, in Abraham Lincoln's terms, the better angels of our nature. Leaders who have educated us and made us better. And presidents are part of that story. It is certainly not exclusive to presidents, but presidents are part of that story. In fact, I argue in the book that the modern notion of an executive actually comes from the American presidency in the 19th century. And here's how I know that. If you go back and look, the word executive was not used as a noun until American presidents became prominent international executives. In fact, the word executive was used as an adjective. You had an executive function, but you did not have executives as such. Our model for an executive, our model for a leader, is in some ways the model of the American presidency. The history of that office, the history of our society, should teach us that what has actually made us the society we've become is the willingness of leaders to encourage Americans to work, to experiment, and not to believe that they have the answers, but instead the capabilities to work together to make themselves better. That's the real point of my book. The presidents who I talk about in my book who were successful were not the know-it-alls. They were not the dictators. They were not the ones who figured it out. But they were the ones who helped others to figure it out. They were the ones who empowered others to figure it out. And I start the book by talking about exactly that because that is the model for an executive that the founders had. They did not want a king. They did not want a dictator. They did not want a general, in fact. They wanted a figure who would reach out to citizens who did not think of themselves as being from one nation, as citizens from Massachusetts and Georgia didn't in the late 18th century. And I live in a state where sometimes they still don't think they're part of that. They wanted a figure who would help Americans to begin to think of themselves as one, begin to work together as they had not before. The problems with the early period after our revolution were that the states were not working together. Americans were not working together. They needed a figure under a constitution that would start to bring citizens together. That, ladies and gentlemen, is what George Washington did as president of the United States. And the model of the presidency was the model of a figure who did not tell people what to do, but empowered and brought together people to make decisions to improve their own lives. In the terms of the time, the president at the top empowered those at the bottom to have more choices and more opportunity in their own lives. That is how a presidential democracy would work. And you must all understand we were the first presidential democracy in the world, which is to say the first democracy with a president, an elected leader for the people with limited powers within a democratic framework. The first 50 years of our country were actually the most creative because this was the period when we invented what that office would look like, how it would operate. If you've read your Constitution, it says very little about how this should work. The Article II of the Constitution is actually the vaguest article of the Constitution. The office developed not from a set of parchment principles, but from the practice of bringing people together to improve and solve common problems. Dealing with the new territory acquired through the Louisiana Purchase of 1803, settling that territory, bringing frontiersmen and women into the larger nation, and in Andrew Jackson's terms, which I talk about quite a lot, clearing Indians off the land as well. All of that was part of the story of the country coming together and presidents inspiring, encouraging, and eliciting cooperation by citizens as they moved in that direction. By the time of the Civil War, the presidency was still a weak office in the United States, but it was also an inspiring office. It was an office that was designed to bring citizens together but leave them to do most of the decision making. Lincoln's innovation was not to undermine local governance, but to create a new framework for a single free society, which is to say a society without slaves. For Lincoln, the problem of slavery was the problem of figuring out how you can empower citizens in a slave society that discourages innovation and discourages individuals to work hard. Right? For a poor white man on the frontier, as Lincoln was, with no property, with limited education, slavery was the worst thing in the world. Slavery was the worst thing in the world. Why would anyone pay him to do anything if they could get someone else to do it? So to eliminate slavery, to solve the problem of slavery, was to actually empower citizens to make better decisions, to build a productive economy. And Lincoln's presidency was therefore the first presidency, I argue, that actually transforms the office from a uniting figure to an actual economic development figure. Lincoln is our first CEO president. He's in fact the first corporate lawyer to be elected president. He was a lawyer for the railroads in Illinois. He in fact tried more appellate cases for the railroads than any other lawyer of his generation in Illinois. That's how he harnessed his ability to argue. And Lincoln did a number of other things that are really important for the presidency. He gave us the words. And a theme that's very important, especially from that period forward in understanding leadership, is the use of words, the use of language. Ladies and gentlemen, we have fallen very far. And it's ironic, isn't it, that we're more educated and we babble worse than ever before, right? We've lost the ability to speak because we don't value the ability to speak, the ability to write, the ability to express in words things that inspire and bring people together. Lincoln, from the poorest of backgrounds, the least educated, less educated than anyone in this room, understood this better than anyone else. He said famously, and I quote this at length in the book, he said when he was a young man, the thing that bothered him most was when he would hear people saying things and he couldn't understand them. My 13-year-old's this way, actually. And he said, what I used to do is I would walk back and forth in my small little cabin, and I would try to put into my words what these others said. And then I would bound the words north and bound the words south and bound them east and bound the west till I found the right words. And then he says, I did this because that is the only way to move the hearts of men. That is the only way to move the hearts of men. This still works. It still happens upon us. Do not for a minute think that people don't read. They better not. We're selling books, right? But do not for a minute think they don't read. I have proof for you that they do. Every time I'm in Washington, D.C., I'm sure, and I hope all of you do this, I go to the Lincoln Memorial. I don't care if I have no time, if it's only 3 a.m., I'm going to go to the Lincoln Memorial. That is my place of religious pilgrimage. And there is never a moment I'm there when there aren't people reading the Gettysburg Address on one wall and the second inaugural on the other. And if you look closely, they're crying. It moves people to this day. It doesn't matter whether they're visiting from Africa or they've come from Ohio. It moves them to this day. What Lincoln does with the presidency is he takes this unifying infrastructure that Washington and Jackson and John Quincy Adams and others had built, and he produces the words to create what we, in a fancy way, call a discourse of nation, but it's actually deeper than that. It's actually a language of togetherness. And he turns the Civil War not into a victory for some and a loss for others, but into collective penance. Right, what does he say in the second inaugural? That every drop of blood taken with the lash shall be paid by another drawn by the sword, and that the cancer of slavery shall be removed, and we shall be a new nation with a new birth of freedom. He's redefining the nation as such and using the presidency for that. Theodore Roosevelt, who revered Abraham Lincoln, gave us the phrase we've used ever since, the bully pulpit. But we need to interrogate that phrase, right? The bully pulpit did not mean you grab people by the lapel, right? The bully pulpit meant, in Theodore Roosevelt's terms, that you use your words to change the way people see the world. And that comes back to my point about history. You can only imagine a new world if you understand the world from which you've come. And Theodore Roosevelt was one of the best at that. He was a historian by training, so obviously I love him. He used his historical knowledge to help Americans imagine their land in a new way, creating our national parks, to help Americans imagine their place in the world in a new way, creating our first modern navy, and to help Americans imagine a presidency that was about lifting us to reform. He took the ideas of Bob La Follette and other Wisconsinites. He actually wrote the preface to the Wisconsin idea when published, took those ideas and gave them a national platform and used the presidency to promote them, to promote a sense of togetherness in common reform and using the right words. My favorite Franklin Roosevelt, my favorite Theodore Roosevelt story is what one journalist tells of meeting Theodore Roosevelt. He says you would meet Theodore Roosevelt, shake his hand, you'd hear him talk, and then you'd go home and you would have to wring him out of your clothes. That's how he got into you. That's how he got into you as such.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Professor Jeremy Suri speaking on his new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office.
Franklin Roosevelt, our last great president. Franklin Roosevelt learned from his predecessors, studied their history, And Roosevelt, born to privilege, recognized that all that those who had come before him to do to build a united country, to promote a sense of progress, to create a common mission, to use the right words, all of those things were leaving certain people behind. And he knew this because for all the privilege he had contracting polio, he spent 7 years of his life in Warm Springs, Georgia, with some of the poorest, most disadvantaged people in the world, people he never would have spent time with otherwise. And he came to see that for all his privilege, he was actually not that distant from them. You wouldn't want every leader to have to live through that, but you'd want them to get that lesson, right? I'm going to digress for a second, but we're very high and mighty in our language about wanting to help others, but not actually wanting to see and touch others, right? We're very comfortable doing it from a distance. And doing it from a distance doesn't actually give us the feeling for what we're actually dealing with. It's very easy to be morally self-righteous, right, from your penthouse, than actually in the space with people, dealing with them on a day-to-day basis, as Franklin Roosevelt had to do. He turned the presidency, I argue, into a national healer, using the words that Lincoln taught him, using the unifying institutions that Washington built, and using the progressive reform impulses of Bob La Follette and Theodore Roosevelt to actually bring the presidency to people who had been left behind for so long. And you all know this. You've all talked to relatives who lived through that period. It's not that everyone loved Roosevelt's policies, but everyone felt touched by Roosevelt. He used the radio to come in to people's homes as no other figure had ever done before. And this is important. He came into their homes to make them feel connected, to make them feel like they mattered. In fact, the New Deal did not solve a lot of America's economic problems, but it made the suffering feel like they were connected and feel like they mattered. In the same way that Warm Springs made those people suffering from polio feel like they mattered and they weren't alone. Roosevelt understood that the presidency is most powerful, not when it is offering simple solutions or simple ideology, but when it is making people feel a togetherness with other like citizens and empowering them, encouraging them, inspiring them, pleading with them to work, pleading with them to do better things. And the man who actually captured that story best, though there are thousands and thousands of these oral histories, is, this will surprise you, Ronald Reagan. People will only tell you part of the story of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was an incredibly complex person, and my views of him have changed doing research. That's why we do research. If you already know everything, don't bother to do the research, right? You do the research because you want to actually learn. Ronald Reagan grew up in Dixon, Illinois during the Depression, and his father, Jack Reagan, shoe salesman, lost his job. It was amazing to my students, right, that he lost his job and his family didn't have shoes. He wasn't selling shoes. People didn't buy shoes. They can't understand that people didn't buy. How do they play basketball if they didn't buy shoes, right? Jack Reagan not only lost his job. This is a story I'm sure you've heard from relatives who lived through the Depression. He not only lost his job, he lost his identity. In a society of male breadwinners at that time, to lose your job, you lost your place. You lost your belonging. You lost your masculinity. He began drinking hard and having trouble with Reagan's mother. And what Ronnie Reagan remembers is that the day his family turned around was the day that his father was hired by the Works Progress Administration, which actually, not the Dixon version of it, but the Austin, Texas version of it, built the school where my kids go to school. There's a nice little plaque. It built the UT Tower, if you see that. It's amazing how many conservative legislators in Texas don't know that. I can't tell you a number of conversations where I've said to them, do you know that actually part of our campus was built by the federal government? No, it wasn't. Let's go walk. There's a plaque. If you just read it, it actually will tell you that, right? What Jack Reagan gained from working for the Works Progress Administration was he gained a purpose again. He didn't get a lot of money, but he gained a purpose. He became a community organizer, like another president. And what he did was he brought citizens together and felt a common purpose, a sense of belonging, and a sense of progress in helping to build new roads and plant trees. Millions of Americans did that. And what we know as historians now is actually what made our boys and girls great soldiers was not their military training, but their sense of togetherness that they had built during the Depression, their sense of belonging, their sense of what their country was about. The problem we have faced since then, what I've given you now is the first half of the book, right? The problem we have faced since then is that through all of these transformations, through all of these struggles, and notice we didn't have any genius presidents. Notice there was no one who had all the answers. Notice I haven't even said anything about one ideology or another because it's all a waste of time. That's not what leadership is about. Ideology is what scoundrels argue over. Leadership is about getting problems solved. That actually, that moment in 1945, our moment of really greatest success, when we defeat fascism and we set a new pattern for Western liberal democracy, of societies that will be capitalist, productive, but also taking care of those who are most disprivileged, those who have the most disadvantages, that moment is the moment when we begin to go in the wrong direction, I believe, because we think we've figured it out, because we stop innovating. We stop adjusting our politics. It's actually quite extraordinary how little fundamental institutional reform there has been in the way our society operates since the mid-20th century. How little we have adjusted to the changes in the world around us. We have spent the last 50 to 70 years as a powerful country more interested in proving our self-righteousness than actually adjusting to the world around us. I'll give you just one very basic and obvious example that you all see in plain sight. The Constitution of the United States very clearly says that Congress declares war. The last time we declared war was December of 1941. So there's some problem there in the way our institutions are set up and what's really going on, right? Because we've obviously been at war quite a lot since then. Some wars we had to fight that were the right wars to fight, some that were not the right wars to fight, some that were our fault, some that were not our fault. But our institutions are not actually properly set up. And the changes we have made have largely been changes that have reinforced many of our problems. Since the mid-20th century, our political system has actually become more dominated by money and special interests than ever before. Since the last quarter of the 20th century, we've invested more time in setting up districts. You know this in Wisconsin better than anyone else, right? Where the representatives choose the citizens rather than the voters choose the representatives. It's a wonderful system, isn't it? And you get to choose who votes for you, right? I wish I could actually, choose which students write student evaluations. You write one and you don't write one, right? We've not adjusted to the challenges of our age. We've not adjusted to being a truly multicultural society in the way we talk about power, in the way we talk about our politics, in the way we allocate our resources. What I try to show in my book is that, and I show this in many ways, what I try to show is that one of the things that has held us back is that we've been doing so many things, we've lost sight of a bigger picture. We have become fragmented. We have tried to make so many things work in our existing institutions that we've overstretched those institutions and not thought about redesigning them in any major way. In the book, I reprint actually presidential calendars. These are fascinating to look at. And you can see how different Franklin Roosevelt's day is from John F. Kennedy's just 20 years later. The number of meetings, the number of issues, the speed. It's not the media that makes the speed, ladies and gentlemen. It's the people who make the speed that the media then recreates. And the urge, the desire to spread and do so much at one time. And the absence, ladies and gentlemen, of creative thought about the larger framework for what we're dealing with. And our ideologies fall into that as well. Our ideologies reinforce one existing institution or another. Look at the tax debate we just started, right? We're going to argue over, within our existing tax system, one person should get a tax break or someone else. Not over whether we actually should fundamentally rethink how we do taxation, which we probably should, right? Which we probably should. What purposes does our tax system serve? Is it serving the right purposes for our country? Is it encouraging the right behaviors? None of those things are probably answered yes. All of those things are questions that won't be addressed in our present debate. Think of healthcare in the same way, right? Is it really a debate about the Affordable Care Act? Or should it really be a discussion about why we spend so much and get so little and so many people have no access? We spend time talking and running, and we spend time doing it within an existing framework rather than rethinking that framework as a whole. I wrote this book because I think this history can, first of all, show us how prior generations rethought their frameworks, rethought their worlds, and can show us how we're not doing it and maybe inspire us to do the same. I don't think there's a George Washington or an Abraham Lincoln who will show up tomorrow and solve all our problems, because those guys never actually did that. But I do think we can create our own possibilities. We can create our own individuals to do this if we look and think historically about our own world and empower people to ask those questions. So the last part of the book actually offers some ideas about how we would move forward in doing that. And I've been saying this to every audience. I'll say it here. If my wife were standing here, she'd tell you I'm much better on problems than on solutions. So just so you know, right? The solutions, that's her business. She's the solution person on the problem business. Hey, this is terrible. What are some ways for us to go forward? I actually think there's a lot we can do. There's a lot. This history is useful history. I believe we study history to empower ourselves today. We study history to empower ourselves today. So for this audience, I want to pick out a couple of the points I make in the end of the book about that, because I think they're particularly relevant for where we all are right now, right? We're in a library. Knowledge matters. Knowledge matters. Facts matter. Everything I say in the book and everything I've just said now, I have facts to back it up. I have evidence. I have footnotes. I believe in that stuff. I believe you talk about what you know and you don't talk about what you don't know, and you invest. You invest as much as you can in learning as much as you can. Yes? Those are things we don't do anymore. We have underinvested in that. We've undervalued that. We've stopped talking about that. And all of us are to blame, because we all go around and find someone who happens to agree with us. We know they don't know what they're talking about, but they just happen to agree with us, so we support them. That is not acceptable. Over the last 20 to 30 years, we have systematically underinvested in institutions that provide knowledge. Systematically underinvested. From Lincoln's time with the Morrill Land Grant Act of 1862 that created this great university and so many others, we were the first country in the world to create public universities for farmers to learn the higher agricultural sciences and the liberal arts, and the term liberal arts was used at the time. From that moment in 1862 to 1970, we have the highest growth in education rates in the world. And strangely, that correlates with economic growth. 1970, it tapers off, and strangely, our economic growth tapers off as well. We have systematically underinvested in knowledge institutions, universities, media that are incentivized to produce the truth, not incentivized to produce revenue alone, in institutions that provide objective analysis. The greatness of this state in the early 20th century was the Legislative Research Bureau here in the Capitol that was filled with young scholars and others who were charged, paid a very, very modest wage to investigate serious issues like worker safety, like affordability and nutrition. And they were charged to bring out the facts so the legislators and the governors could actually make policy based on facts. That seems so quaint, but you've been to Washington. It's not how it works. It's not how it works in Madison, right? That's our decision, because that's our money. What are we spending our money on instead? One of the things I witnessed in this state as a professor here for 10 years, and I loved living here, were graduates of the University of Wisconsin who came to the University of Wisconsin with no money and became CEOs, right? University of Wisconsin produced more CEOs than any other university. And they then said they didn't want to pay their taxes and they would take care of their own. They still gave us donations, which was nice. They didn't want to pay in because they had already won and they could do enough to take care of their own. We can blame the politicians all we want, but until we have a frank discussion and look in the mirror at ourselves and ask ourselves about the choices we've created, the incentives we've put forth in our culture, that's not going to change. And all the presidents in the first half of my book that I revere, they were all about education. George Washington actually proposed a national university of the United States as the third point of his legislative program. Abraham Lincoln created our public universities in the midst of the Civil War. Theodore Roosevelt believed that every citizen should get a college education. He didn't think it could happen then, but he believed that. He pushed that. He would tell any young citizen, you need to go to college. Right? That was what he believed. Franklin Roosevelt created the GI Bill, right? That not only allowed veterans to own homes, allowed them to go to college. About 10 million veterans go to college as a consequence of the GI Bill. We used to believe in that. If we don't invest in that, there's no way we can make better decisions. There's no way we can solve our problems. We can pontificate, But we can't solve our problems if we don't invest in that. Second point I want to make, and then I'll stop ranting. One of the biggest problems we have is that we give too much power now to too few people. The early presidents who I talked about are presidents who were majestic in their accomplishments, but they actually had far less power than our presidents today. When George Washington leads American soldiers, and he's the first and last president to lead them into battle himself in the Whiskey Rebellion, he has to actually go state to state to ask the governors to give him soldiers. Some states do, some don't. Some governors accompany him, commanding their own soldiers. Can you imagine that world today? Imagine Scott Walker commanding soldiers out there. I couldn't resist, I'm sorry. I wasn't supposed to do that, but I couldn't resist it. When Abraham Lincoln is raising the Union Army, which becomes the largest land army in the world during the Civil War, from 1861 to 1863, he has no power to conscript. He has to go and ask the governors. In fact, Wisconsin is one of the first states to offer the largest contingent of Union soldiers. He has to ask them. It's far less power, far less power. We've now given more power to fewer people. We still call ourselves a democracy, but in many ways we look more like an oligarchy. Well, let me put it this way. If you compare our election system to others, and you look at how much influence citizens have on outcomes in elections, we are one of the least democratic societies among democracies in the world. We have very little influence over who gets chosen by the parties, very little influence over how the campaign is run, who is running for which office where. It's the money and the gerrymandering and voter restriction that makes it difficult for people to vote. And then the people who are elected do things, more often than not, telling us only after the fact, right? Telling us only after the fact. This is not how the system should work. It's not how it did work. It's not what our history teaches us it should be. And that history should remind us that that should change. Those are incremental decisions that have happened the last 70 years. Those are decisions that can be reversed. And while we're on it, I do have to say this. There is fraud in elections. The fraud is that so many people are prevented from voting. There is no fraud in who votes. So how do we go forward? I'm an optimist, those of you who know me. I'm an optimist because I'm the child of immigrants from Russia and India, and I get to do this, and I get paid to do this. I mean, I have wonderful children. I mean, I'm an optimist. The world is filled with possibility. I'm also an optimist because I have the greatest job in the world. I get to teach young people. And I'll tell you something, the undergraduates in my courses, I have 400 of them on U.S. history since the Civil War, 1865 to the present, they get better every year. They get better every year. I've told this joke before. It's true. My wife and I interview students who are applying to Stanford now, because we both went to Stanford. And I interview some of these students now. They're probably kids like yours, kids like mine. And I come back and say, I could never get in. I couldn't compete with these kids when I came out of public school in New York City in 1990, right? They get better, at least those who are in our universities. They get better every single year. And not just that. These millennials that we rag upon, right? They do spend too much time on these things, on their iPhones. But you know something? They're problem solvers. You know something? They want meaning in life. When I started teaching 15 years ago, gosh, makes me feel old. When I started teaching 15 years ago, my students, my best students, wanted to go work as financial consultants, and they wanted to work in finance because that's where the money was. They don't want to do that now. My best students want to go work in places where they'll be well compensated, but they'll take less money if they believe in what they're doing, if it's meaningful for them. They want to live in a place where they can make a difference, a Madison or an Austin, and they want to actually have work that they believe in, work that is making the world better. The thing that is stopping them, that's holding them back, and my real problem, is the parents, not the kids. Every day, one of them comes into my office every day and says, I really want to get involved in politics. I really want to go out and be a human rights activist. I want to get involved in children's education. But my parents tell me to study engineering, study business, and get a job. And I understand the urge, right? Parents have taken out a second mortgage to send them to school. They have debt. But that's not what's driving these kids. And what we have done in the last few years is we have set ourselves back because we have told them to do all the wrong things. We have not told them to invest in their future, and we've actually made it harder for them to get involved. We have had, in the 2016, two 70-year-olds run for president, and then a 76-year-old with Bernie Sanders. And he was actually the most refreshing of all of them, wasn't he, right? We have the second oldest Congress ever. The oldest Congress, the one right before. After 240 years, the oldest Congress ever. Wow. Is this a good investment strategy? Our problems have been solved. This is what my book is really about. By men and women in leadership positions, they don't have to be presidents, working together, finding new ways to bring others together to solve problems. That's what democracy can do that no other hierarchical organization can do. A hierarchical organization can't adjust as well as we can. We have done that in our past. Because we did it so successfully, we stopped doing it because it was easier to live on our laurels. We became fat and happy. And it's time for us to go back and get a workout and put younger people in charge. So if nothing else, think about that, please. The presidency is impossible because it's an old presidency with an old man, and a really troubled old man. The new presidency we need, the new leadership, has to be young, experimental leadership. And the solution is staring at us in plain sight. It's our young people around us. We have the best talent. We're just not putting the talent into power. The office will remain impossible, no matter who is elected, until we start putting the young talent there rather than the old ideological leadership we have today. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Professor Jeremy Suri speaking on his new book, The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy Suri is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and also taught at UW-Madison. The talk took place at the Central Library in Madison on November 2, 2017, and was sponsored by the Madison Institute and the Wisconsin Book Festival. To find out what else the Madison Institute is up to, go to their website at themadisoninstitute.org.